Blog Talk Radio.
Returning to their family, that means they've been fired or asked to resign or
as we could tell. We got Larry coming up in about 10 minutes. So I'm going to go back to this. Come on now.
What are you doing?
I'm just waiting. I'm waiting for this machine to bring us this news for you. This here, why don't you read it?
Job list rate unchanged in December. Economy adds 155,000 jobs. The nation's economy added 155,000 new jobs in December, and the jobless rate was unchanged from November, as adjusted 7.8%, according to figures released this morning by the U.S. Bureau of Labor and Statistics. 155,000 jobs created reflected 34 straight months of positive growth. Let's see what else they said on this. Deep problems still remain in our economy and labor market. Underemployment remains at 14.4%. Wages are barely growing, and too many workers are seeing their skills atrophy as they sit on the sidelines.
I wanted to go back to I want you to read this one here.
Conjuring a high-tech labor shortage. Let's see what they have to say about
that. That's one of the biggest problems. Yeah.
We hear two views about the high-tech workforce. Yeah. On the one hand, employers warn of dire labor shortage. On the other, recent high-tech graduates can't find jobs. Many face crushing student loans that they may never pay off. Mid-career high-tech workers are steadily being let go. Discouraged mid-career workers take lower-paid service jobs after months of searching for a good job, or one at least as good as the one they lost. Let's see what else they say about this. Employers get plenty of applications, but they can't find qualified workers. Peter Capelli at the Wharton School studied this situation. He finds that employers are hiring more selectively, looking for the ideal match. It's not enough to be able to do the job. Employers want someone already doing that exact job. I'm reminded of one employer desperate for an engineer with several years of experience with a 2.2 gigahertz antenna. All the employer could find were applicants with experience at 1.9 gigahertz. At an aerospace conference in Tacoma, a local employer was very upset about the mismatch between skills of the applicants and jobs. At the moment, he said earnestly, 3,726,000 jobs were open around the country because of mismatched skills in the labor market. I thought, huh. I pulled out my laptop and found his statistic at the U.S. Bureau of Labor and Statistics website. It was the total number of open jobs in the country that month. The employer was arguing that all job openings in the country were going unqualified because workers lacked the skills to perform the work. A similar thought process applies when Microsoft's general counsel, Brad Smith, expresses alarm about 6,000 unfilled jobs. Well, are 6,000 openings at Microsoft higher than normal, lower than normal, or typical? I checked. In 2006 and 2008, employment at Microsoft went up at least 8,000 workers. More to the point, in 2009, Microsoft laid off more than 5,000 workers. Plus or minus 6,000 seems typical at Microsoft. A Microsoft human resource manager told me that its percentage acceptance rate for job loss offers is in the low 90s. That means Microsoft could fill more openings by making more offers. Another measure Microsoft uses for high-tech labor shortage is that underemployment for engineers is low compared to the country as a whole. Putting the statistics into context, we come to the opposite conclusion. Economists argue that a chronic labor shortage is technically not possible. The problem is not a shortage of workers. Rather, employers are offering too little. That's something else we can check. Are salaries going up? Not really. Engineer salaries, college enrollment, and employment have been very slowly inching up over many years. During the tech boom in 1999, we did see a real labor shortage. Employers offered signing bonuses. Job applicants could negotiate having multiple offers of employment and workplace perks were profiled in glowing newspaper accounts. Nothing remotely like that is happening now. It's worth noting that Microsoft is currently campaigning to flood the high-tech market by dramatically opening our immigration system to foreign high-tech workers. Microsoft's talking points align with its policy demands for more foreign workers. However, labor market statistics and graduation rates say we have plenty of workers, in conclusion backed up by the life experience of thousands of unemployed and underemployed domestic high-tech workers. We can duel over statistics, but the deeper issue is working here. More and more employers see themselves as global companies who want flexible labor practice. That means less commitment to long-term careers, more global outsourcing, more frequent layoffs. Microsoft and other high-tech employers use legions of contractors and contingent labor. Europeans call this precarious employment. The IT industry is notorious for discarding older workers and replacing them with younger workers who are compensated at a lower rate on the pay scale. In 1996, Intel's chief operating officer, Craig Barrett, told his stockholders, the half-life of an engineer is only a few years. Jeez.
Wow.
In the July 6, 2012, Wall Street Journal, 3G Studios CEO James Costa said engineers were outliving their usefulness from one project to the other. When a project ends, it's better to reevaluate your entire staff and almost just hire new. Oh, boy. The approach may have a certain logic in the motion picture business. However, it sounds harsh when you hear it from a NASA mission commander for the Mars lander, who guided his spacecraft to a successful landing and is now looking for work. Years ago, employers used a different workforce strategy based on long-term careers rather than short-term jobs. New hires needed basic skills. Once in the workplace, they would develop expertise through on-the-job training, knowledge transfer, and experience. In that view, the best job training is a job. A retired general told me the military also needed experienced specialists. He was often asked if he could get enough 8-year master sergeants. He said he could get all he wanted. It takes 8 years. Microsoft and countless other employers are making a conscious business decision to commoditize work and turn to the labor market to satisfy their precise demand just in time. But as a result, they have a problem with labor shortage. It's a problem of their own making. Okay.
All right. So that's interesting. So what we're going to do is dial up Larry Dorman right now, and we will be.
And we'll be talking to him about the state of affairs, and maybe we'll talk to him about the fiscal cliff, what he thought about that.
Yeah, and we're still.
I think we're still hanging.
We're still hanging there, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. I wondered what he thought about that last ditch effort.
Hello.
Hi, Larry. Good evening.
Hey, how you doing?
How are you?
Hi, Larry.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, actually, we're recovering from laryngitis, and each of us had a 3-week cold.
Oh, no. There's, you know, flu. It's Boston declared a public health emergency with flu. It's all over the place. So,
I saw that, I work in a school, as you know. And
yep, you work in a germy environment.
It's a little germ factory, and people are dropping left and right with flus and colds, and kids are sick,
yep.
and
Oh, boy.
It's just a bad time right now for illness.
Yeah.
So
not good. Well, take care of yourselves.
Oh, we're much better now. We're on the road to recovery. I just hope everybody else recovers around me.
Exactly.
So
what did you think of the falling off the fiscal cliff?
The dramatic last-ditch effort that we had there so we didn't plunge over to oblivion.
Right.
Well, I mean, you know, I think that it's interesting because I think people were under the impression that once they arrived at some kind of compromise, some kind of agreement that this problem would go away, and it, you know, it's not going to go away. It's going to keep coming back and back. And the congressional Republicans clearly want to cut programs. They want to cut Social Security. They want to cut Medicaid and Medicare. They're throwing up a gauntlet to protect the rich and the corporations. So you know, the debate is not going to go away. That's all.
They haven't released, as far as I can see and find anywhere, they haven't really released what they actually did pass, all right, other than they extended unemployment benefits and capped it at $400,000, I guess, is the...
when that's what, you know, but again, they...
They screwed around with the taxes again, because there's going to be higher payroll taxes, all right?
It's funny, the AFL-CIO had posted on their blog a piece about recently about you want to cut the deficit, start by closing the Mitt Romney loophole. You know, that's a really good, it's actually, there's a group called Think Progress, because people like Romney who manage these investment funds get paid in two ways, right? Part of their income is, I guess it's like a management fee that's taxed as regular income, at the top rate of like 39.5%, but fund managers get a cut of the profits, and that's taxed as a capital gain, et cetera, et cetera. So end, that what they showed is that, Romney ends up paying a tax rate of a little less than 14% on $20 million, and millions of middle-class workers are paying a much higher rate on much lower salaries. So, when I said at the beginning, they really didn't tackle the fundamental issues of fairness and equity. They didn't. And so we're going to have to revisit this rodeo once again and watch it play out in its sordid fashion, many more times.
That would be, amending the tax code, right?
Correct. Which can be done. This is why, labor our argument in organized labor has been that you got to look at all these loopholes. You've got to look at things like the financial transactions code putting a tax on these, one-button transactions that are done over the Internet that yield millions of dollars that aren't taxed fairly. There's a whole bunch of things that can be done without having to cut programs that people actually need. And, we'll see if people... Have the guts to stand up and fight for that stuff. It's going to be an interesting and wild few months.
We certainly are dealing with a tax code that needs a review. I mean, when that tax code was developed, CEOs weren't making the amounts of money that they're making now.
Right. They make, American CEOs make something like 425 times the average worker on the shop floor. I mean, it is just outrageous what's going on. And, they're rewarded for failure often enough. They're rewarded for layoffs. And so,
look at the hostess.
So, again, they can afford to pay a little bit more. And, so I don't think we saw an ideal agreement come out of that initial fiscal cliff.
I have to ask, I saw the Secretary of Labor today resigned.
Yes.
That was a surprise, wasn't it? Was it to you? It was to us.
Right. It was very much a surprise, and I don't know what prompted it, because obviously there's always turnover in the second term.
But nobody
had said
it didn't have any I mean, you knew that Hillary was leaving, but, you know, you didn't hear, and you knew that Geithner was going to go, but you didn't hear anything about her.
And she was, and she's friendly toward labor, so.
Very much so, and she's been, but, you know, more importantly, she's been a very good Secretary of Labor. Her predecessor, Elaine Chao, went in there to dismantle the Labor Department under Bush and to block initiatives and programs that helped workers. It was a employer-oriented department, which is not supposed to be. It's supposed to be there for all workers. And Solis did many good things to, I think, change the direction. So I don't know what happened. Obviously, I'm guessing there was some personal reason for doing it, because I don't believe she was asked to resign, as many of these cabinet positions are often asked to kind of politely go another direction in the second term. But I don't think that was the case here. So we'll see what
time brings out on that. I was just very
I was too. I don't think anybody was expecting this.
I hope that he gets.
Very pro-labor.
I hope we get somebody that's as good as she. Very sad.
I'm with you on that. I'm with you on that. And, you know, again, it's we're heading into these really volatile, we're in them already, but, you know, these are very volatile times, and we need good people who are committed to doing the right thing.
What do you see for 2013 here? And what do you think that what do you think the chances are of us losing our credit rating again? Looks like Moody, if we don't get this debt ceiling thing.
Here's the thing. I mean, you're right, and that could very well happen. Yet, you know, all of this seems to me to be a rigged game.
Yeah.
You know, the ratings companies who are, you know, these big powerful corporate entities unto themselves, and we've been known to also be somewhat inaccurate. You make these horrible dark pronouncements, and then, you know, bond ratings go down, and you know. But again, it's what you're asking. What do I expect? I expect to see an even rougher battle than we saw in the first go around of this ongoing fiscal cliff argument. I think it's going to get very ugly. Yeah, I think the tone, even, you know, from sort of some of the non-economic things that are happening, you know, the president wants to appoint people to positions, and whatever you think of the quality of the choices, I'm not passing any judgments on Chuck Hagel or on Lou or some of the other people that Obama is nominating, but already the Republicans are just reflexively saying that's not acceptable. So, you know, they're going to continue being the party of no, and they've got enough votes and a filibuster ability in the Senate to really keep things gridlocked. So I don't see positive things, Leo.
I don't either. I don't either. But the one thing that I do see is somewhat encouraging is the, the talk about coming out of Afghanistan, the talk about possibly, I read yesterday somewhere about a positive look at the work program, you know, at the public works program again. That's still on the table.
Yep.
I don't know if that, it just can't get through the Republicans right now. But one thing I was going to ask you, and I don't know if you understand this or not, or I have difficulty figuring this one out. How can the Federal Reserve be buying up all of these mortgages, all right? $40 billion a month are going into these failed mortgages, okay? And yet the Republican Party doesn't stop that. That's our money. That's our time. The silly thing is, for every dime that the Federal Reserve puts out there, the taxpayer owes it, all right?
Plus.
Right.
Plus, you know? And so how can they possibly allow this spending of unlimited monies, all right, on failed mortgages, okay, to rescue the banking industry again, all right? And and not understand the debt ceiling. I mean, the debt ceiling has to increase if the guy keeps spending $40 billion, you know, every month.
On
right?
failed mortgages.
On bad stuff.
Yeah.
All right? On bailing out banks. So, I mean, I just don't, I just can't understand the logic behind the Republican thinking at this point. All right?
Well, it's because you're looking for logic.
They don't understand the system.
You know, I'm not being why. They're protecting the very people who have gotten us into this mess. And look, to a certain extent, there were many Democrats. So I don't want to be, I don't want to pick on one party. But we're looking. You and I and Lyle are looking at this from a logical standpoint. And, a fiscal sanity kind of standpoint and an economic fairness standpoint. These guys, particularly the Republicans, they would rather drive us all over the cliff so they can force an absolute disaster, epic disaster of an economic crisis. That's all I can tell you. I mean, that's
what it looks like. And why would they want to do that? How would it serve?
What benefit is that?
How
really?
Would it serve them?
It's the old line about William Cowley and Me Lie, destroying the village to save it, right? It's ingrained in their philosophy that they're so committed to protecting the 1% that it really doesn't matter what damage they do to everyone else and everything.
It's kind of the attitude of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, you destroy this country. I mean, that's not going to help them. I mean, or
I would
just
think, but I think there really is. They're playing brinksmanship, and a lot of these politicians in D.C. are just playing economic brinksmanship, and we're all the pawns. So, I hope it doesn't shake out that way. But they're daring Obama and the Democrats to fight them on this stuff. And, we'll have to see what Obama and the Democrats are made of and how they bring their message back out. I'm not capable, like you, I'm completely confounded by the scenario you just described. I've been reading about it, but the fact that this whole thing unfolded in 2008, when the regulators knew it was happening and the politicians knew it was happening and everybody pointed a finger at somebody else, it was the debacle then. Why shouldn't it be a debacle now?
We had a number of years ago, this guy named Andrew Goss, when we were on Q103, actually, he was a gold bug, okay, he's made a fortune since then, the shows, but he was advising to get into gold coins and gold. But he was also an economist that taught, would actually teach the incoming senators,
Congress, yeah.
Okay, the senators and congressmen, all right, about the banking system and about what financing was. Okay,
they'd have little seminars,
how the
I guess.
Economic system worked in this country, how the banking system worked in this country. Mm-hmm. And he said, even after he would go through a week of explaining this in seminars and talking, he says, they still don't have a clue. He says they still wouldn't have a clue as to how money works. And he says it works through the banking system, and the bank, for every dollar on deposit, the banking system can lend out nine. And he says,
right. The
way money is made is through lending. All right? He says that's how money is made. That's how jobs are made. That's how the economy moves.
So the minute bankers understand very well, the minute you tighten that up, the economy goes down the tube.
Exactly, so.
And that whole engine comes to a grinding halt, and that's
they,
basically
exactly.
what they've done.
So when Congress is in, like, stop spending all this money, stop spending, well, it's absurd to stop spending when you are the one that are issuing the money.
Right.
I mean?
Right, well, look, that's why, look, there's always been a difference between the federal deficit and the state deficit, right? And that, I know that sounds like an obviously a dumb statement, but or so dumb it's so obvious it sounds dumb or stupid or uneducated. But here's the deal, the federal government prints money. So they can do stimulus packages, and which, by the way, we need.
Oh,
in fact, There are a lot of economists who will simply argue, by virtue of the fact that the federal government can print money and can move forward with its stimulus programs, that the only way left right now to put people to work, you know, is to spend on infrastructure and is to, you know, create programs that are going to put people to work. And, you know, the only thing I'd say describing what that economist said, you know, the irony, though, is that with the mortgage crisis and the burst of the housing bubble in 2008, he's absolutely right. These guys nailed it, right? They figured out a way to bundle all those bad loans and make a ton of money. And
yep.
That's what caused the bubble to burst and sent the economy tanking. They were so good at it, you know, they manipulated the market. And you know, these dopes in Congress continually changed laws, regulations, codes, and, you know, allowed it to happen because they didn't, I don't think they quite understood what was happening. And the bankers, as usual, you should go listen to the Woody Guthrie song, Jolly Banker, sometime.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You know, these guys are fat and happy, you know, because they're in collusion with Wall Street. They're actually, you know, lending gazillions of dollars out there, bundling the loans, turning them into a risky, high-risk investment vehicle that made them money while the rest of the country burned.
And
you know what I mean? It's interesting.
And then the same brokerage is betting against their own investors.
Oh yeah, well,
right.
Goldman Sachs did that regularly.
Yeah.
It's a horrible thing.
Yeah, they were pushing these horrible things and
knowingly
betting against them, knowing they were going to fail.
And they would
right.
put out to their customers prospectus that they would take a look at privately and would have offers on. They would decline to buy it themselves, but they would send it out to their customers and push it, knowing it was a bad investment.
Right.
So
by the way,
thoroughly dishonest firm.
They were completely indicted by the Senate Investigation Committee, Goldman Sachs especially, but J.P. Morgan and a number of those guys. Okay, were criminally indictable. Okay, they were criminally responsible for this. And what happened is the reason that Goldman Sachs got a free pass recently, you remember? I don't know if you heard, they're no longer prosecutable, okay?
Correct, yeah. They all got a free pass pretty much, but yeah.
I guess why? It turns out that Eric Holder, his law firm, their biggest, longest accounts are Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, what's the other big one? Oh, the three major brokerage houses on Wall Street are Eric Holder's law firm's clients.
Biggest client.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. Yeah. No surprise. Right.
Is that a collusive? Is that a problem there?
Wouldn't you think that's a little bit too close?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, of course. But, you know, I watched a PBS Frontline. They did a wonderful. Did you see their three-part series they did earlier in 2012?
Yeah.
On the meltdown. Remember, there was supposed to be this showdown at the White House where Obama was going to chew out the CEOs of those companies you just mentioned and a bunch of the corporate pigs, and they let them go home, and they just didn't bother, you know. So, these guys skated. These guys have skated. It doesn't really matter which party's in control. They Wall Street wins. So,
I mean, they had those Senate hearings. They were laughable.
No, actually,
right.
They came very very important, and when they came on, and Levin read the indictments and stuff. You thought something was going to happen.
Yeah.
And then six right. months later. You know, Goldman Sachs and all of the boys are walking with no indictments.
Well, that's good theater, is what it was.
Yeah.
It's good theater.
Yep.
But getting back to what you said originally, Leo, that about what Andrew Gause said about the senators and the congressmen, I think that's a very important observation because, you know, they no longer read their own bills. They no longer really bother to become educated on the bills that are being passed. They have staff that go out and look into all these things.
And their supporters want them to vote in one certain way.
Right. So
they vote at all, you know.
So they don't really, I really question whether they do their due diligence at all. It's so
no, I can tell you they, I can tell you they don't. You know, this is, the place is a swarm with lobbyists who actually do the real work. And, you know, and I see it at the state capitol, you know, legislators just getting all their information, you know, not from constituents, not from real people, but from lobbyists who are their conduit, their only conduit to reality, and that's not exactly reality.
Well, it's also an easier way to do your job. You just go and listen to somebody and say, okay, I agree with you. You know, it,
right.
it requires some fortitude and independence and a sense of real responsibility in what you're doing to do a good job at that. That's not an easy job. It requires someone who really cares to go and look into those things and find what the best route is for their constituents. But they don't seem to be made of that kind of metal today.
That's a great observation, Lila, really. It's a failure of will, nerve, whatever you want to call it.
And you know, it wouldn't be so bad if it were the minority of people, but today it seems to be like the majority. You always get slackers everywhere. Let's face it, you always do. Wherever you work.
Wherever you go, yeah.
The mainstream news media, okay, is probably the greatest problem that you got there, because I read this on the air a while back, that almost 90% of the news on the network news programs, okay, most of the copy is either written by the government agencies, or the companies that are their sponsors, the pharmaceutical companies or the energy companies or whatever.
Yeah. I know too many journalists, who at least in this state within Connecticut, I don't see government agencies, you know, writing their stuff. But what's happening is that with layoffs, with, you know, an emphasis on profits over quality, with a rush to get things first rather than get them right, with the digital age upon us, there aren't as many reporters. And I will agree with you that that corporate ownership of the media has actually changed the game for the worse. So I will agree with you on that piece, that, you know, I don't think it's that the government agencies are doing it. I think it's that the corporation...
They will not allow them to read anything unless it's
okay.
approved by the White House now. All right?
Yeah, no, I hear you, but I just, like I said, to me, the bigger problem is that the corporations are running the show in the press, you know, that they actually, they own
well,
the media.
New York Times writer that one a couple months ago, it was last year, came out with that scathing op-ed about how the government, how Obama, this White House, okay, won't allow anything said without, you know, that's not verbatim in their press release, okay, and that they really hurt the reporters if they do. So it's like it's kind of strange. But not only that,
well, it's all about control,
but,
Leo.
Yeah, but the pharmaceutical companies, and the energy companies, these lobbyists or these, you know, the companies themselves send out the information, and they're. And the networks pick this stuff up and read it out there. Just, you know, they're all right in their news programs. And, you know, over 90% of the news is actually written for them. You know, it's stuff
that
they just, you know.
It's no different than the lobbyists educating the representatives that we send to Congress and down to Hartford.
And you notice you don't see any reporting from anywhere anymore, any countries that have closed almost all of their international
foreign news bureaus,
right?
Yeah.
You only get from Reuters or from a few.
And I thought that was a sad day when that happened.
Yeah, Associated Press.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree.
A very sad
day. So, you know, but again, you know, the corporate ownership of the media and domination of the media,
militates
against a fair dissemination of facts and the truth. So you're getting it. You know, the corporations aren't going to allow a lot of these stories to be told. That's all there is to it.
That's why it's so important that we have, you know, blogs and websites that, you know, like yours and like the AFL-CIO that give the other side. More and more people, I bet, are going to these, because I noticed the other day they were I read somewhere that the listenership of the major networks and cable news is really down. The numbers are they had very, very low numbers. It was, I was shocked. I can't even think of the number actually.
Well, they're saying 20 million overall.
Yeah.
From all the networks put together, they get about 20 million viewers. And this article compared them to the 2.5 billion websites, news agencies, blogs, independent journalists, you know, that are on the internet, and the alternative news sources. And he said, you know, it's just washing out government and network news, issued news, because nobody watches them anymore.
Well, especially young people, they don't get their news that way at all.
And
mm-hmm.
nobody
no,
trusts
no,
the government.
No, they get it. It's completely different for them.
They're over the internet.
They get it from everywhere. Yeah.
John Stewart.
Which I'm okay with that, actually. I'd rather get it from John Stewart, you know. He's a more reliable source than the mainstream press.
Mainstream press, he is.
So are there any particular issues that you're working on in Hartford right now that the union is backing?
The legislature did actually open for business today.
Yeah.
We'll be keeping an eye on things. There's the continuing sluggish economy, the state deficit, and but we are going to be pushing away. We want to make sure that there's adequate and appropriate and equal funding for the cities and towns so that we can provide services. We want to make sure that people can access pension security. We're going to be pushing our pension for all legislation again. We're going to be working on some collaborating on some worker rights issues, so definitely we'll have more to talk about as the legislature gets underway.
The next time you're on, I'd like you to elaborate on your pension for all. I think that would be...
That's what I'd like to talk about, and we pushed the bill last year. It was just to be a study committee, and it didn't make it, so I think it's a bill that doesn't sit well with a lot of folks in the financial services industry, but essentially it involves having sort of a hybrid pension plan that private sector workers could buy into. So because obviously most workers just don't have any way of retirement security. So I'd love to talk more about that next time.
Yeah, I think that would be a great discussion for next time. I look forward to hearing more about that.
Good. And by that time, you guys will be all healed up. You'll sound better.
We'll sound a little bit better.
I'm concerned. I don't want you guys. We need you healthy.
We're going to stay that way. It was great to have you on,
Larry. All you warriors fighting for a just society, you need to stay healthy.
Yeah. You too.
You too.
All right. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Larry. It's nice to have you.
Good. We'll talk soon. All right. Bye-bye.
That was Larry Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator for AFSCME Union.
Yep.
And next time, we'll be talking about a pension for all. That's an interesting concept. So I think people will be interested in that, something that people can buy into.
Yeah.
And what did they say about China?
Well, there was something here that was a little video here.
That's the third page. So we're on the AFL-CIO site. It was a little video that...
what are we going to do? Why don't we just go to a quick music break?
Okay, well,
right.
We find this. Yep.
And then and we'll be right back.
So we'll be right back, folks.
Yeah,
we'll find this audio piece that we want to play for you. Put it in the search piece there. part where you can find what they have. It was probably a few days ago.
It was just out there. Don't find it. Yeah. I'm sorry. Okay, well, this is too bad because everything's kind of changed since.
It
has. Yeah, it has.
Well, just talk about what that debate was about, and maybe people will have time to go to that. It's probably on.
It's probably on
YouTube.
It should have been up.
Somebody probably posted.
I would think so, but.
So when did they debate?
Oh, I forgot. I can't do it with this thing. They debated about two or three days ago.
Mm-hmm. Alex Jones had him on his show. Is that?
Actually, it was on the Piers Morgan show. Alex Jones was on the Piers Morgan show.
Oh, okay.
And they got into quite a fight over the issue of gun control.
Well, I'm sure Piers Morgan was in favor of it.
Okay. We're doing so well here tonight. We're trying to get this stuff. It keeps slipping out of our hands. Well, if you can waste less time trying to find it.
Well, why would it be in David Icke's?
I just went to it because I couldn't find anything else on that. I couldn't find the chunk of speech that I wanted to play. You're not going to go anywhere that way.
Well, here it is. Piers Morgan and guests laugh about shooting Alex Jones.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to get that one.
See what it says.
Doesn't have
it. No, I can't play it on here. That's too bad. I'd have to go to something else in order to do it. Well, anyway, if you go to David Icke's site, you'll be able to play it if you have a Flash player. We don't have that on iPad, so I can't do it.
What I wanted to do before we do go anywhere else, I don't know why we can't just grab something there.
Okay, this is mostly English.
Show up for the...
Nine-step process bankers use to force global slavery upon humanity. How about this? Below is the nine-step process bankers use to enslave us.
We had a slight accident here because an animal. Now I don't know where we are. Lost our...
Here, the nine-step process bankers use to force global slavery. Number one, teach lies as truth, like markets are free, and we need to spread democracy to the rest of the world. Plant Asian provocateurs in all movements of resistance, like OWS, to discredit these movements whenever possible. Bankers teach lies like free markets exist throughout all business curricula taught in the institutional academic system. When the central banks set artificial interest rates, this means the free market is not setting interest rates. Bankers are rigging stock markets, real estate markets, currency markets, and commodity markets all for their benefit and due to the detriment of all other humans on our planet. Furthermore, if you study democratic principles and whether governments that claim to be democracies actually abide by these principles, you will discover that most every democratic government operates on a fascist platform and not a democratic one, stating that a free market coexists in a country in which a central bank retains the monopolistic power to set interest rates is as impossible a relationship as the physics maxim that states two objects cannot occupy the same space at the same time. Furthermore, bankers use the lies they teach in school to further other lies like the existence of capitalism. Without free markets, capitalism cannot exist. If free markets do not exist in the world because central banks and not the free market set interest rates, then by logic, capitalism cannot exist. Okay, number two. Commandeer and effectively take over all control of global governments, mass media, state police, federal military elements to suppress the truth from reaching the masses. Simon Johnson wrote about how bankers have taken over our government in his excellent article, The Quiet Coup. These two excellent articles, Here and Here, explain how banks directed state police and government surveillance agencies to crush all dissident in opposition to their criminal activities. The fact that the state police and government agencies bowed down to bankers like servants proves that these countries in which these incidents are taking place have been far along more fascist than democratic. Mussolini or Pinochet could not have asked for a better cooperation and better obedience. They've taken over the education system, designed it to dumb down instead of enlighten the masses, and export this model to the rest of the world. When you just as above, they've taken over the control of global governments and suppressed truth and stuff. They did that with the occupation of Wall Street. They tried to suppress any of the truth that they had, and they infiltrated that whole movement, which was too bad. Take over the education system, design it to dumb down and enlighten the instead of enlighten the masses. Western bankers have funded and exported to the rest of the world an institutional academic system that serves as a behavior modification camp responsible for dumbing down young adults and turning them into obedient, non-thinking worker bees. This is how you create a new world order in which just a few thousand bankers can capably control 7 billion people and keep them in line. Bankers and industrialists like the Rockefellers and the Carnegies financed the development of our global education system during the American Revolution, and thus were able to promote the lies they wanted the masses to embrace, such as the myth that America experienced a revolution in 1776, and that the U.S. President Abraham Lincoln ended slavery in 1863. The bankers were always happy to give the colonialists the illusion of gained freedom as an outcome of the Revolutionary War in exchange for maintaining their control over the newly formed republic's monetary supply. Thus, the Rothschild banking family quickly established the Bank of the United States, which has since become the U.S. Federal Reserve today, through their colonialist agents in the United States in 1791. When this bank's charter expired in 1811, Nathan Rothschild of the Bank of England and the Rothschild banking clan declared a grave warning. Either the application for the renewal of the charter is granted, or the United States will find itself involved in a most disastrous war. When the U.S. Congress chose not to renew the bank's charter, Nathan Rothschild responded, "Teach these impudent Americans a lesson. Bring them back to colonial status." Even though African Americans were given their physical freedom in 1863, they were never granted their financial freedom by the bankers. How does Lincoln end slavery in America with his 1863 Emancipation Proclamation when just 50 years later, the bankers financially enslaved everyone with the founding of the U.S. Federal Reserve? To declare that Abraham Lincoln ended slavery in America in 1863 is as big a myth as the lie that Columbus discovered a land called America. How does one discover a land that has already been inhabited for hundreds of years by millions of Indians? Furthermore, Columbus wasn't even the first European to arrive in America, as Vikings had beat him to this feat by hundreds of years. A.M. Reeves and N.L. Beamish and R.B. Anderson's The Norse Discovery of America documented in great detail the epic and ferocious battles between the Vikings and the native inhabitants of Vineland, the Viking word for America, as far back as the 10th century, about 500 years before Columbus stumbled upon America. So how did Lincoln end slavery, and how did Columbus discover America? The answer to both questions is that they did not. The end of the physical enslavement was merely transformed into a new kind of slavery, financial and mental slavery. After the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, the Warburgs, and the J.P. Morgans were able to form the U.S. Federal Reserve in 1913, bankers extended their slavery empire not only over blacks, but also over whites, over Asians, and over Latinos, extending their empire of slavery all over the world. Thus, slavery was never eradicated in 1863. That's probably too. And we've come to the end of our show.
Yeah. So don't believe anything you hear, except on this show. And we appreciate your listening. And thank you. And please join me tomorrow night when we talk a little about a few different other things.
Yeah,
so,
this is an interesting article. If you go to this Smart Knowledge U, the 9-step process bankers use to force global slavery upon humanity.
Yeah.
And we're economic slaves, all of us.
That's what we are.
You know, and that's worldwide. It's not just us.
That's exactly right. So we want to thank everybody who joined us. And we wish you a very pleasant night. Good night, everyone.
Good night, folks.